And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
So much hanging in the balance. Is there another shoe set to drop? Hurricane Ike takes a swing at the coast. An emerging global economic meltdown. Presidential campaigns shooting spitballs in the halls of history. And worst of all, the latest O.J. Simpson trial has locked up headline news. Priority one, the search for a way out. In America, we call that quest an election. And somehow, Sarah Palin has been chosen by the Republicans as the most qualified and ready person to lead us all through the storm. Who is Sarah Palin? Our quest to know is coming up on your Voice of the Earth, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Wow, what times we live in. People in the Gulf Coast are sorting through the debris of Hurricane Ike that's driven Galveston back into the sea, as Houston struggles through the dark to find the switch to turn on the electricity. And while that storm wipes out our oil refineries, while the McCain campaign says that the answer to lowering oil prices is to drill, 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 the price of oil drops $60 a barrel to around $90 now. And then globalization smashes a fist on the American economy as an otherwise solvent company, AIG, with over $1 trillion in assets, is reduced to ashes and burns the economic foundations of nations around the world. And while all of this happens, O.J. Simpson is back in court with live coverage on headline news. Beware the Ides of September. It's clear to me that who runs this country has dramatic effects at every level on the lives of we here in the United States and people around the world. All my life I've believed in an enduring America, a land of the people, by the people, and for the people. But that has been turned on its head by a few people who believe in some form of the golden bough, the divine right of kings to rule. The decider will decide, because he knows better what's best for us than the people themselves. I'm beginning to think of this place in history from the perspective of trends. It's the best way for me to define what drives my decision-making. And in so many areas, the economy, America's legacy, the environment, energy independence, education, health care for real people, the prospects for peace, the trends in recent years have all taken a huge, giant step backwards. So when it comes to deciding who will move us forward, I have to look at who will advance the trend lines most effectively and in which direction. Today, we continue our look at Sarah Palin, who, if elected, will win the crown as chief decider, to see how she might affect the trends of change. Today, we focus on a wide spectrum of decisions which Sarah Palin has influenced as governor of the state of Alaska, to help us understand the impact she would have if elected in November. This show is in two parts. Listen and pass it on. Last week, I focused on Sarah Palin, the new vice presidential candidate running with John McCain, and it's just an ongoing saga that keeps developing. And quite honestly, it's very confusing. It's hard for me to sort out who she is based on the myriads of stories and things. And so that's what we need to know, though, because at this point in our history, these decisions that will affect the environment are very likely decisions that will affect literally many aspects of life on Earth, and as well our way of life. And certainly today, as the economic train wreck has apparently happened again, we have hard decisions for this country to make. And so who takes the control and leads this country to wherever we go is critically important. As it relates to the environment, I'm looking for people who have real experience with Sarah Palin. And so I want to invite to the show Peter Van Tine, who's with Bessonnier and Van Tine in Anchorage, Alaska. Peter, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Peter, give us a handle on what your perspective is here and why this can help us to understand Sarah Palin better.
Sure. I'm an environmental lawyer in Anchorage. Most of the last 20 years I've spent working here, loving living here, spend a lot of time in the outdoors, so that gives me a lot of concern for what's been going on and passion to work on the issues. But from a professional perspective, I'm an attorney that represents conservation groups, national conservation groups, Alaska-based conservation groups. I've worked on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge campaign for 15 years or so, as one example, do a lot of marine fisheries conservation work and other oil and gas work as well. And I also represent Alaska Native tribes and villages on these similar issues, whether it's working with the Gwich'in people to help protect the Arctic Refuge or the native village of Point Hope, which is a small community, the oldest community in North America, far northwest Alaska. It's a whaling-based community for subsistence purposes, and they are very concerned about the massive expansion of oil and gas activities that the Bush administration, with the support of the state, is pushing offshore of their coast. That's my background, and it's something I felt privileged to do, but it's also given me some unfortunate experience with state of Alaska politicians.
You know, for those of us who live in other parts of the world instead of Alaska, we all have our images. My image of Alaska is it's a very, very large place. Most of the population lives along the coastal areas with vast open spaces. Give us a sense of the degree to which the resource extraction really affects, let's say, the people and then the place specifically.
Well, I mean, you can look at it economically, I think, is probably the biggest impact that it's had. When Alaska became a state in 1959, we were able to accept a fair amount of acreage from the federal government. We were a territory, and as part of our deal coming into the Union, the state of Alaska got about, I think it was 35 million acres or so, that it took title to, and that included, luckily enough, although I think there was some good intelligence that went into the decision, the area around Prudhoe Bay. And this is in the 1960s where that big elephant oil field that still provides so much oil to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was found. And now there's an industrial area around Prudhoe Bay that's roughly about bigger than Rhode Island, actually. Mm. And it's a web of development that extends about 110 miles across the coastal plain. On the state lands there, and is heading into the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, which is federal, a large block of federal land. And there's just a lot of money that comes out of that to the state of Alaska. We've got about $36 billion in the bank account. We've got about, 85% of our annual budget comes from those royalties on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, so we do not have a state income tax. We do not have a statewide sales tax. Our property tax burden is focused on your county or your municipality, and in most cases is pretty reasonable, especially when you look at it in the big picture. So economically, the state residents have done quite well. Just last Friday, I believe it was, I have a family, a wife and two children, and just by virtue of the fact that we live here, we received just over $12,000 in money from the state of Alaska.
Now, is that an annual bonus?
Well, the money changes. It's called a permanent fund dividend, and it's part of our savings account is committed over to providing a dividend to the residents of Alaska. Anyone who's been here longer than a year and has an intent to stay here is eligible to receive the permanent fund dividend. This year, that was about $2,100. That might be the biggest one ever. Typically, it's between $1,000 and $1,500. And in addition, on top of that, Governor Palin she made the decision to provide another $1,200 payment to every resident who qualifies for the dividend. On top of that, as a sort of energy help, was the idea. There's no limits put on what you can do with the money. But what it meant is about $3,300 for every resident of the state that came into bank accounts last week. And, that's a pretty fortunate position for states to be in.
It's kind of a form of Social Security.
But, you know, and it's you know, to everybody, you know, as long as you live here, again, with the for over 1 year, the intent to permanently remain, you're eligible for it. So a lot of people get it. Family of four, that's a lot of money.
It is. It is. A lot of people, of course, it's very expensive to live in Alaska. Certain aspects are. So.
You know, I Sydney, I think that's true for the Bush communities. Uh-huh. I lived in D.C., though.
Yeah.
For, you know, actually in the early 1990s for a couple of years when I worked for the Department of Justice. And I found the cost of living there to be pretty high as well. So for Anchorage, yeah, the cost of living I don't think is significantly. It's not cheap to live here, but it's not super expensive. But
right.
If you're in the Bush communities, you're right. If you're off that road system and you're in a more remote area, a lot of the Alaska Native communities, you're talking very significant prices for your basic staples, whether it's milk and other things. There was a report in the paper today about $11 a gallon milk in one community, as well as gas prices. It's a little ironic given that we've got so many of those resources in state, but we have a difficult time getting it to some of those remote communities
right.
at a reasonable price.
Yeah, it's an unusual mix, Alaska is. It stands alone. One of the perspectives that I keep trying to sort out here is there's a side to Sarah Palin that comes across as someone who is very dedicated to sort of providing a stable economic backdrop for the people of her state. And you know what? I respect anybody who's fighting for that. I guess the question would be, what's the price that is being paid for that, particularly as it relates now? We'll kind of shift over to the topic here. And that is the price that will be paid in terms of the environmental degradation and other larger realms. We're talking now about obviously oil and gas exploration, mineral exploration, mining, offshore fishing, hunting and predator control issues. It gets to be a little bit confusing, so I'm turning to you now to help us understand this dynamic and try to figure out what is Sarah Palin's modus operandi and her vision.
Let's talk about that economic-environmental interface for a moment, because the one thing that Sarah Palin holds herself out to the nation as is someone that stood up to the oil industry. And let's examine that for just a second, because I agree, she did. She came in following Frank Murkowski, who by all accounts was the worst governor that Alaska ever had, by far. Former senator, ran a bank before being a senator and had some economic troubles with that bank in southeast Alaska and was a senator for a long time, and then he came home as the governor, and by all accounts was the worst governor that Alaska's ever had.
He has a rough reputation.
He didn't do anything to polish it up as governor, I can tell you that. And
yes.
He lost in his own primary to Sarah Palin. So mm-hmm. She came in with a pretty low bar to raise things up in the state. When she did stand up to the oil company, it was on some of the issues that Frank Murkowski had fallen down so flat on, including the Trans-Alaska Gas Line. And really, that was pushing something. I think she did we'll see, it's not done yet. She characterized it as a finalized project in her speech at the Republican convention, but it's far mm-hmm. from it, many years away mm-hmm. from even beginning construction. Mm-hmm. But she did stand up to them on some tax issues that changed the allocation, if you will, of the money that comes out of the oil fields and gave the state a lot more money out of it. And that's great, you know, so it's an economic allocation between the oil and gas industry and the state of Alaska. I don't know how that relates to things that everybody else can get excited about, but for people in Alaska who, you know, get permanent fund dividends and big treasury hits from the oil and gas companies, that's great. Now, that does not mean, though, that she's been any different than previous governors on environmental issues, and I can give you several examples of that.
Okay.
You know, let's start with the oil and gas industry on the North Slope. It's something that the Bush administration, as I mentioned earlier, has been pushing a very strong expansion, especially into the offshore environment and into parts of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, and the Western Arctic. Large parts of that NPRA, as we call it, are, you know, legitimately good for, as its name suggests, petroleum production. And at the same time, back as far as the 1970s, when that place was dealt with in some federal legislation, there was a recognition that, boy, we don't know a lot about the NPRA. Let's be careful and analyze all of that information before we go forward. In the 1980s, James Watt, under President Reagan, who was by many considered until Gail Norton probably the worst Interior Secretary for the environment, he even protected a couple of areas in the NPRA when they were doing some lease sales then, and long time had blown off some of those protections, and only after multiple court battles and fights were we able to protect some of those areas, at least we'll at least temporarily, let me put it that way. So we see that as background, and the Bush administration also expanding offshore. Recently, they went in the Beaufort Sea from 9 million acres offered in leases to about 33 million. In the Chukchi Sea, we went from 0 to 40 million. And in the Bering Sea, home of some of the nation's biggest fisheries, went from 0 acres to about, I think it was 5.6 million that they'd like to lease there. And so what does this have to do with Sarah Palin? Well, the state has a huge influence over whether or not the federal government should be expanding oil and gas leasing onshore or offshore. The local communities on the North Slope borough, for example, and a lot of the native tribes and villages that live in smaller communities across that North Slope have been vigorously opposed to the offshore. They're marine mammal hunters, and they're very concerned because this is the truth. As a nation, we have no technology available to clean up oil in that environment if it gets spilled into it. And it's especially true if it happens when it's ice-covered or broken ice environment. It's not going to be easy to clean up at all, and the success rates are minuscule. I've been out on the Beaufort Sea in their experiments to determine whether or not that any kind of proposed new technology might work, and it was just a farce almost, with these kind of mops that they would put in the water and squeegee through a roller, and then have it bring it over onto the barge and try and put their simulated oil into a tank, and it didn't work at all. It was just a real farce, as I mentioned.
Is the issue partly this? I mean, certainly there's no doubt that America definitely has to address its energy needs. Obviously, there's a lot of energy potential up in Alaska. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure that's going to be put on developing that. But the real question is this: as that moves forward, should we be take into consideration in the most appropriate ways possible scientific and regulatory safeguards to make sure that as that develops, because it's going to happen, it's not going to stop, the pressure is there, but that at this particular time we should really be conscious of our need, and we have the scientific capabilities to really develop strategies to make this right, or at least to do the best we can. Is it part of this the fact that it's being sort of reversed, that some of those regulations are being taken away at a time when they should be increasing?
Yeah, the executive has so much discretion to do things correctly or do things poorly, and on the federal and state levels, we've just done it extremely poorly. And you're absolutely right that we should be looking at those kind of technologies, but we're never to the point where you are required to put them in place, prove them up before you open up these vast areas. And once you give vast areas to the oil industry, we know what happens. You can see examples of it all across the United States and all across the world. Is you get pollution. That's just the way it is.
Okay, it will happen. Yes.
Yeah. It's a necessary thing. It industrializes the area. So look at the offshore area, and let's apply the example to how Governor Palin has executed her duties there. And we see that animals like whales and polar bears can be impacted by that offshore activity. And as we also know, the United States cares for its wildlife, and Congress has passed many laws to protect it, including what is really almost the Noah's Ark, if you want to put it in religious terms, for someone like Sarah Palin, of those laws, which is the Endangered Species Act. And you had the Bush administration proposing to list, after multiple lawsuits forcing its hand on the issue, the polar bear as a listed species. And Governor Palin was fighting that every step of the way. In January of this year, she put an opinion piece out in the New York Times where she said, look, my state wildlife experts have done a comprehensive review of polar bear science, and they do not believe that listing the polar bear is the best result, is the smartest thing to do, is justified under the science. And so we looked at that as conservationists in Alaska. I mean, the federal government under the Bush administration, of all people, I mean, this is a pretty high scientific standard that they would require a polar bear protection strategy to meet. And they did 9 studies on various aspects of the polar bear issue, on polar bears themselves and ice in the Arctic and the projections into the future, and concluded that the best science, all of them said, we really need to do more to protect this bear. Let's put it on the list. And so in the end, Secretary Kempthorne at the Interior Department did, after many delays, many of them illegal, but finally, he was forced, after a court order, to issue it by a certain date, May 15, 2008. And he did. On May 14th, he announced that the federal government, the Bush administration, was listing the polar bear. And, you know, holy cow, that's, you know, again, the Bush administration doing it. So you know they were up against the wall. And the Governor Palin still opposed it. In fact, since then, she's filed a lawsuit against the listing. But let me tell you what happened along this whole period of time is that that comprehensive review that the state of Alaska supposedly did, the scientists of the state of Alaska supposedly did, doesn't exist. What does exist, they reviewed, the experts in the state agency reviewed the federal science and those nine studies that were done by the Interior Department to support that ultimately supported the listing. And they said internally in the state of Alaska that that is the best available science, and in fact, those studies support listing. So you had, this is very disturbing, you had Governor Palin taking what internally her scientists said and 180 degrees rewriting it, portraying to the public that her scientists had said the exact opposite. And then she refused to give to the public here in the state of Alaska that information, because we tried numerous ways to get it. And in the end, we went to the federal government under the Freedom of Information Act and got the information about the state experts from them. You know, how ironic that is, but we were able to use the federal law because the state had stymied all of our efforts under state law to get it, including proposing about, I think, $500,000 in search fees for public records to find one review of a few scientists. I mean, just exactly the kind of chilling effect that the Bush administration has done on a national level, Governor Palin does here. And the openness and transparency that she claims to be a hallmark of her style of governing is not something that I've seen here as a lawyer. I mean, I deal in the minutiae, and the legal minutiae for Sarah Palin is as complicated and labyrinthian as it has been with previous governors. And so, you know, that's really unfortunate. And I think the theme on that one is she's really willing to quash science in favor of her policy goal, because listing of the polar bear, the impression is among the oil industry people and the real big drilling boosters is that you will have to be more sensitive on your oil and gas activities to polar bears if it's listed, and therefore, if they're listed, and therefore, you know, we don't want it to be listed. And so she fights it, you know, hand in hand with the, you know, American Petroleum Institute and all the rest of the people that don't like those kind of things.
You're making an interesting point there, that it's these patterns of behavior that I think people need to look at, because it's the disingenuousness of her style that concerns me, because we must rely on science. Science is based on finding truth and finding facts and making right decisions about things, and certainly life is based on making right decisions. And it's this pattern of what I can only refer to as deceitfulness or disingenuousness that really concerns me, and certainly you've made that case very well in terms of this issue of the polar bear. And then on top of that, what really bothers me is that she then takes that truth and spins it out during her acceptance speech to say that she stood up to the Bush administration on this issue. Now I don't know the best metaphor, but that's adding insult to injury. In terms of communicating to the public and trying to give us a sense of who she is.
You know, it's state a lie and then repeat it regardless of consequences. And, you know, look, but you know, I think you mentioned that she, and I agree that she can manipulate or quash science, but I think she also has a disdain for science. And this is the best example here is probably the climate change science.
Yes.
We've got international experts. We've got, you know, so much unbelievable scientific body of knowledge out there about the reality of climate change as well as the human causes of it and contribution to it. And, you know, no science is in this kind of area is ever going to be perfect, but the questions about human influence on climate change have really narrowed to the point where it's only the most extreme people that will say that the human impact is not there on climate change. George Bush doesn't say it anymore. Ted Stevens doesn't say it anymore. You know, that leaves Don Young out there among our national you know, congressional folks and a few other people in Congress who say that. And Sarah Palin.
Yeah, you're right.
And in this context, she's to the right of George Bush.
Yeah.
You know? That's quite a maverick.
Well, maybe she's been, off, and I don't mean to demean people off in Alaska. It's a beautiful place to be. To be honest with you, there are times that I wish I was off in Alaska because things are so confusing here, you know.
It's more disingenuous than that if you think about it. I mean, what's the political result for Alaska of denying a human element to global climate change? Mm-hmm. And this gives us an insight into her politics, in my view. On the one hand, she doesn't deny that global warming exists. She can't deny that. We're front lines.
She does admit that it exists. She's already said that.
Yeah, you bet. Mm. We're front lines. You can't do it. Our communities in the bush that are on the coast are falling into the ocean. Our permafrost is melting. Our infrastructure in some areas is crumbling, and we've got to put a lot of money, a lot of it federal, into shoring that up.
Yeah, they just announced that there is now an Arctic pathway open this year, which hasn't happened, and this is a wonderful statistic, that this is the first time that that passage has been open in 125,000 years. So, yes.
You end up with opportunities from climate change in the terms of the economics of having a northern route across the top.
Exactly right.
And you end up with the concern about the impacts here, and we need to put to deal with the impacts of it. So we need, money to deal with that. So she wants to make sure she can get in line with everybody else for that. But when you leave out the human causes of it, what does that allow you to avoid? Aha, it allows you to avoid any limitations on your development activities to take your climate impact into account.
That's true.
And so, therefore, unfettered oil and gas activity, that can both have an impact on the environment where it occurs, as well as nationally and globally in a climate change context. This came up in the one interview she has deigned to give, or they've let her give, since she's been nominated as vice president, Charles Gibson. And she had a back and forth about it, and it's quite a revealing back and forth.
I don't know how long Sarah Palin has been in your radar screen. How long has she been sort of involved in your world?
She first really came to the attention of the political powers that be here, as mayor of Wasilla. It doesn't really get a lot of attention, but she had enough, ability to talk the Republican talk that she had run for lieutenant governor at one point and lost, but at that point, Frank Murkowski appointed her to one of those sweetheart jobs in state government as this oil and gas commission, and so she became chair of that. It was about $125,000 a year position. It's kind of it's not that she had any experience in oil and gas stuff, it's just that's where young Republicans go to cut their teeth, if you will, and so while there, she exposed some corruption that was going on with the Republican Party, to her credit, and that's when she really got on people's radar screen. It had to do with one of the other people on the commission, who was also the Republican Party chair, passing some privileged memos to oil industry lawyers that had to do with drilling plants, and just completely inappropriate, way out of line, way out of line activities that he was doing, and she called him on it and ended up resigning, and that set up her race when she beat Frank Murkowski because the corrupt. I mean, we are extremely corrupt here from an oil and gas industry perspective.
Sure.
If you look at, what goes on in the state legislature, if you look at what goes on with all of our politics here, it's, industry pervades everything.
Well, you're not alone in Alaska with oil and gas industries having a lot to say and a lot of power.
Yeah.
It's kind of a universal theme right now.
Unbelievable what happened at the Interior Department, too.
Yes.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Excusing
billions of dollars in royalties because of it.
Ready to lead. No second thoughts. Sounds like the decider on steroids. Stay tuned as we continue our look at the prospect of President Palin.